How does that affect your work as British ambassador here?
Well, it has obviously made it much more difficult in a practical sense. People are literally scared of meeting us. I have noticed, even in my 2 years here, the number of people who are willing to meet me has shrunk. It was small when I arrived, and now it's smaller. We know that the kind of people that we might have met in earlier times in think tanks, in the academic world, never mind diplomats, have been formally told that they have to report any interactions with unfriendly embassies. And since we're at the top of that list, I think that particularly affects us. So the circle of Russians that one can talk to is smaller, but also the job is narrower. I mean, there are large areas of work which the embassy did when I was last here 20 years ago that we just don't do at the moment. Cooperation in science, in technology, in climate change, in arts and culture, education. These are things which, you know, in current circumstances are not happening.
How difficult is it to travel around the country? I mean, do diplomats still have the chance to travel around?
Well, it is possible to do a certain amount of official travel. I mean, I've just been in Murmansk, and I was in Archangel earlier this year because we've 2025 was obviously the 80th anniversary of the end of the Second World War, and it was an opportunity to remind people of the contribution of the UK to sustaining the Soviet war effort, because as you know, vital supplies were brought in through the Arctic convoys to northern Russia to sustain the Soviet war effort in the sort of vital first couple of years of the German invasion of Russia. So going to places like that and paying tribute to those who lost their lives in that effort is tolerated. We have a consulate still in Yekaterinburg, which I'm able to visit. I would say if I tried to do an official visit with formal meetings anywhere else, it's pretty much impossible. People won't meet you. It'll be as difficult as possible. Suddenly a demonstration will appear. And so for the rest of Russia, you can do personal travel, but official travel it just doesn't work in current circumstances.
And, I mean, I don't know if you can talk about it or not, but, I mean, when we travel outside of Moscow, very often, not always, but very often we sense there are people sort of following us or keeping an eye on us. Would that be the same for diplomats?
Oh, yes. Yeah. No. We assume that by one means or another, people are following our movements and who we're talking to and what we're up to. And, I mean, that has always been the case, though. I mean, you know, one feature of the current landscape, which I think is not new, is this obsession with following foreigners around Russia. But it always, of course, it particularly applies to us and in current circumstances, all the more so. So yes, some of it tips into overt harassment. That's quite rare, but thankfully, but does happen, as you may have seen outside this building on when we mark our National Day. There's quite often a crowd of concerned citizens outside making a lot of noise and trying to intimidate our guests.
Is it dangerous for Russian guests to come into the embassy?
We have people who have been quite frightened by their experience in coming here. We know people have been spoken to afterwards and have found that quite intimidating. And some people's reaction is to dial back on contacts with us, either for a period or completely. And that's deliberate. And I think it's part of a broader effort, unfortunately, by the Russian state at the moment to really try and minimise contact between Russians and Europe. It feels like, to me, a sort of historic reversion of the trends that we saw here in the 1990s and the early 2000s.
Does it feel to you, because it sort of feels to me as if some kind of new Iron Curtain or Berlin Wall is sort of going up, some new barrier between sort of Russia and Europe?
I think there is definitely a conscious and deliberate and systematic effort by the Russian state to reduce contact between Russians and the West. And if you look at the increasing controls of the internet, to make that difficult online as well as physically. Is it total yet? Is it a total wall? No, thankfully not. And, you know, part of the reason that we're here is to make clear to ordinary Russians that that's not the kind of relationship we want. You know, the Kremlin might be trying to reduce their contact with us, but that's not our policy. And indeed, it's not the kind of relationship we want with Russia writ large, and that a different type of relationship would be on offer if Russian behaviour outside its borders changed.
Britain obviously has lots of ambassadors around the world. Trying to be objective, I mean, how challenging would you say the job of British ambassador in Moscow is compared to the others?
Well, thankfully, this is not one of the posts that we categorise as a conflict post. But in terms of the relationship with the host government, this is right up there. I mean, this is one of the most challenging. It's certainly the most challenging job I've done in my career. It's what makes it interesting. It's never easy. It wasn't even easy, you know, 20 years ago in better days.
You're listening to The Interview from the BBC World Service. People shaping our world from all over the world. For this episode of The Interview, I'm speaking to Ambassador Nigel Casey, the UK's top diplomat in Russia. We sat down for tea at the ambassadorial residence. It's a majestic building, a plush Moscow mansion. It was built by a sugar tycoon in Tsarist Russia and, rather appropriately, boasts one of the sweetest locations in Moscow. The ambassador's balcony has the most breathtaking view of the Kremlin, which is just across the river. OK, let's return to my conversation with Nigel Casey.
How much contact are you able to have with the Russian government, with the Russian authorities?
It's very limited at the moment. Generally, if you see me going into the foreign ministry, you can put a decent bet on it being bad news. And that's not because we don't want to have constructive conversations with the Russian government. I think it's actually a pretty vital part of my job to engage and to try and make sure that dangerous misapprehensions or misunderstandings of our role and intentions are defused wherever possible. But it's rare. I think I've seen the relevant deputy foreign minister 3 times this year.
What's it like when you're sort of summoned to the foreign ministry? What's that experience like?
It varies. If it's a serious conversation, then it can be quite straightforward. If it's a bit of a media circus, then the Foreign Ministry Press Department will arrange for a group of rather familiar-looking journalists to turn up outside the front door, and they'll play all sorts of games trying to make you look stupid on the way in and out. That's part of the sort of rigmarole, really, of that kind of information operation, as they call it here.
What is the hardest thing for you as an ambassador here, as far as your job is concerned?
I think the hardest thing for me is worrying about the pressures on my staff. I think my staff tend to get a harder time quite often than I do directly. They not only get followed around, sometimes they will be harassed and quite a lot of the time they might be separated from their families and feeling quite isolated. And so a lot of the job is about making sure that the team's welfare is looked after. I think my responsibility towards them is probably the thing which keeps me awake at night more than anything else.
Another question that I get asked from time to time is, why are you still there? Western journalists should pull out of Russia in protest. Why do you think it's important for example, British diplomats to remain here? Yes, I've heard people say, just build a big wall, just forget about Russia. What do you think?
Well, first of all, from my employer, the British government, there's never been a greater demand for analysis, information, understanding of Russia, what drives Russian decision-making, what we can expect from this country's leadership, I suspect the demand for our work has probably not been higher since the end of the Soviet Union, the great period of huge uncertainty. So that is a large part of my job and why my employer sends me here. Because there is so little other contact at the political level between business groups, the embassies in our two countries really are the main remaining thread on which our relationship hangs. And I think it would be extremely dangerous if we didn't have at least this limited ability to communicate with each other. So that's, again, a core part of our function. And the third is, as I mentioned earlier, I think, and for me, perhaps the most important in the long term is to send a message to Russians that, you know, we're not walking away from this relationship. We've never wanted to have any kind of rupture, and we want a different relationship in the future. But that does depend on fundamentally different type of Russian behaviour outside its borders.
And I suppose Russia. I mean, Russia's not going anywhere, is it? And the biggest country in the world.
Yeah, no. Yeah. Russia's it's a great myth of Russian propaganda that we ignored Russia and forgot about them. You hardly ignored Russia. You've been reporting this story for three decades or more. We never have. It's a compelling story. Russia generates a lot of news, mostly bad, but it's never news that you can ignore. And it matters for our interests, particularly the security and stability of the European continent, and so that's not something we will ever walk away from voluntarily.
Do you get a sense, because very often I get a sense that I'm living in some kind of alternative reality or parallel reality, how difficult is it to sort of live and work in that kind of atmosphere, that kind of landscape where black is white and white is black?
You do live in a parallel universe of Russian propaganda here, and I encourage my team make sure I get out of Russia regularly to remind myself what normal looks like. And because after you've been here for a while, it's very, very hard to ignore this sort of tidal wave of untruth which comes at you 24/7. And you find it starts to seep in, and I understand why Russians start to imbibe some of this stuff when they hear it. So constantly. One of my favourite discoveries is that Lewis Carroll visited Russia in 1867. It was the only country he ever visited outside the UK. And some people claim that he wrote Through the Looking Glass as his response to his experience, even in 1867, of this country and quite how different it was. And he talked about seeing the city reflected in a false mirror. I think that there is something that about Russia that has endured for that length of time, but the inoculation against it is to get out regularly and reset, and then come back refreshed and clear about where the truth lies.
That's fascinating. I had no idea that Lewis Carroll had been here.
He came here on it was actually an ecumenical visit. He came to visit the Orthodox Church because there was a fad for reuniting the Eastern and Western churches, and he met the Metropolitan of Moscow, and he visited Moscow, St. Petersburg, but also Nizhny Novgorod. So the place obviously made a deep impression. He talked about hearing the jabber of voices, because he obviously couldn't understand Russian, and again, some people claim that the Jabberwocky was his response to hearing such an unfamiliar language spoken around him and not having any idea what it meant.
Fascinating, fascinating. What do you like about Russia? What are the things that attract you to Russia?
Well, Moscow is still in many ways a great city, and one of the things that one can still enjoy despite everything here is the cultural offer that Moscow has. I try as far as possible to take opportunities to go to the theatre, go and see new films, go and listen to the really world-class music that is on offer here every night of the week. There are new openings of exhibitions, even if it's having to use the resources within Russia rather than cooperating with any foreign institutions these days. And I studied history at university, and Russia is steeped in it. And so I find all of that rich and fascinating, and that's what keeps me going here. I'm sure, I imagine you feel the same.
Absolutely, yeah. Just bringing the conversation back to the political situation here, another question I get asked a lot on air, constantly, is what is Vladimir Putin thinking? You know, what's in his mind? And I expect to an extent that's a question which kind of you're looking at on a daily basis. Is it possible to know? Is it possible to work out his thought processes, his thought patterns, what his plans are? Because I suppose that's kind of the answer to that question is key.
Well, a lot of it is they're hiding in plain sight. I would always recommend to people reading Vladimir Putin's speeches and his public addresses, some of the particularly seminal ones, his famous Munich speech in 2007. If you look at the speech he gave to the foreign ministry in June 2024 about his goals for the war in Ukraine, his famous essay on the historical unity of Ukraine and Russia, a lot of his innermost thinking is on the page. Now, can you take it all at face value? Well, that's a challenge which you know, I think it requires people who've been here as long as you have to take judgments on. But there is a consistency about President Putin's view of the world and his objectives, which I think you can trace back. Maybe it's easier to do it in retrospect, but you can certainly, sitting where we are today, trace it back to the very early days of his time as president. So, I mean, this is an extremely closed political system, and I think Winston Churchill said something about he compared Russian politics to the bulldogs fighting under a carpet, in the sense that it was only after you saw the outcome that you knew, you had a sense of what had been going on. But it is, I think that's part of the fascination of my job, and I guess yours, is that we have to assemble a jigsaw puzzle with only a few of the pieces, and fill the rest in with our own experience and knowledge. And I think with Vladimir Putin, there's a lot of clues in public, and some of the other bits you have to fill in for yourself.
Thank you for listening to the interview.
Call in this area, you must dial the area code and the phone number. For assistance, please dial 611. Message 9, PA01GN.
Bye. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Yeah, so what?
Out in Signal Land, we have Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
We have Gila.
Good evening.
And we have Alex.
You do. Good evening, actually. Good morning.
Are you all right there?
Yeah, I'm okay. I'm in London, so it's a little bit late, but I'm here.
Okay, good.
So good evening, good morning, whatever.
Yeah, all right. Well, I just came from the dentist, so I'm not in a good mood. So just keep that in mind. And, a little hard to talk as well. Here we are, another Wednesday night. A couple of program reminders. We have overtime following the show tonight at 8 o'clock, as usual, on YouTube. Check the link on 2600.com or just go to channel 2600 on YouTube. You can be part of an extended conversation on Hope, for one thing, and also call us and participate. Next week, though, that will not be the case. Next week, we're doing a call-in right here on WBAI. It's our monthly call-in show for BAI listeners. So mark that on your calendars and make sure nothing gets in the way. All right, we have some follow-up news for some things we talked about. Remember the creepy ring camera ad that aired during the Super Bowl that kind of freaked people out? Yeah, they thought it would win people over by finding a lost dog, but it actually scared the hell out of people when they realized that all the ring cameras could be turned on at once and used to track down somebody, dog or human. Amazon and Flock Safety have ended a partnership that would have given law enforcement access to a vast web of Ring cameras. Yeah, it's the power of consumers right there. The decision came after Amazon faced substantial backlash for airing a Super Bowl ad that was meant to be warm and fuzzy, but instead came across as disturbing and dystopian. The ad begins with a young girl surprised to receive a puppy as a gift. But she's irresponsible and doesn't take care of her dog, and as happens every damn time, the dog gets away. And I'm adding that part just so people realize the importance of it. 10 million dogs go missing annually. 10 million. Showing a series of lost dog posters, the ad introduces a new search party feature for Ring cameras that promises to revolutionize how neighbors come together to locate missing fugitives and dissidents and pets occasionally. At that point, the ad takes a creepy turn, according to my old friend, Senator Ed Markey, who told Amazon CEO Andy Jassy in a letter urging changes to enhance privacy at the company, or maybe introduce it, illustrating how a single Ring post could use AI to instantly activate searchlights across an entire neighborhood. The ad shocked critics like Markey, who warned that the same technology could easily be used to surveil and identify humans. No one had thought of that. No one realized that. But wow, yeah, I guess you could. Markey suggested that in blasting out this one frame of the ad to Super Bowl viewers, Amazon inadvertently revealed the serious privacy and civil liberties risks attendant to these types of artificial intelligence-enabled image recognition technologies. Yeah, and, you know, as incapacitated as the Super Bowl audience might have been at the time, they got it. They got that message loud and clear, and they rejected it, almost as much as they rejected the boring game. In his letter, Markey also shared new insights from his prior correspondence with Amazon that he said exposed a wide range of privacy concerns. Ring cameras can collect biometric information on anyone in their video range, he said, without the individual's consent and often without their knowledge. Among privacy risks, Markey warned that Ring owners can retain swaths of biometric data, including face scans, indefinitely. And anyone wanting face scans removed from Ring cameras has no easy solution and is forced to go door-to-door to request deletions. Has anyone ever done that? Gone door-to-door to request that your face be removed from there? Try it. It sounds like a lot of fun. They're easy to see. You know, when you have a Ring camera, everybody in the neighborhood knows because it's this brilliant light. I don't know how to describe it, but it's obvious, right?
Yeah, there's a blue LED.
Mm-hmm. There's a blue LED light, but also everyone in your office knows you have a Ring camera because every time someone walks by your front door, there's this chimey noise that it makes on your phone. And it is the single most irritating thing in the whole entire world. I do not entirely understand how Ring doorbells have been a net positive for the universe, because nothing they do is good.
Well, I mean, unless, you know, somebody's at the door, I guess. But, you know, we have doorbells that do that anyway.
Right. And when people live in New York City, in apartment buildings that have door staff, and still get a Ring doorbell, like, that's just the dumbest thing I could possibly think of.
yeah, I guess it is, that ranks up there. Anyway, Amazon announced their partnership last October, a partnership with Flock. And, you know, we don't talk about Flock cameras enough on this show. We really should some more because, boy, there's all kinds of security issues with that. But their partnership was announced in October, and that inflamed the fears right there. So did the company's recent rollout of a feature using facial recognition technology called Familiar Faces, which Senator Markey considers so invasive, he has demanded that the feature be paused. What this ad doesn't show, Ring also rolled out facial recognition for humans, he posted on Twitter. I wrote to them months ago about this. Their answer, they won't ask for your consent. This definitely isn't about dogs. It's about mass surveillance. Could it get any more creepy? Yes, it can get more creepy. Alex, I'm sure you have some thoughts on that.
Yeah, sure. The whole thing is extraordinarily creepy. But, I mean, look, it's not surprising in a sense. I mean, it was somewhat well-intentioned. It was an ad that was really designed to tug at your heartstrings. It had a dog in it. The dog was lost. It had a little girl. It had kids and all kinds of things. But, I mean, it's so ironic, right, that this – or I guess maybe ironic isn't the right word to use here, right? But I guess it was an unintentional consequence of the use of this kind of surveillance technology that it turned into a really neat little surveillance contretemps, in the sense that suddenly everybody realized that cute doorbell cam in the ad is also a cop cam that's pointed right at their front yard. It's a crazy thing. Like, it took this to wake everybody up. But the good thing about this, to my mind, is that people did wake up. People did see it for what it is. I mean, that says to me that we're still rational beings. We can still be we're still okay. We're on the right path.
Yeah. When we what if they hadn't had the ad? What if they hadn't put the ad out during the Super Bowl? What if, you know, so many people hadn't seen this? It would be fought, you know, by the usual suspects in courtrooms and things like that. But it wouldn't have gotten the attention it's gotten now. So, you know, in a way, I guess, you know, if you just let the companies be themselves and brag about what they're doing, they'll hang themselves with their own rope. You know, it's basically the only way to really open people's eyes.
Yeah, look, they hoist themselves by their own petard, so to speak, all the time, right? But you're totally right here. I mean, the other way this could have gone down was that they silently roll this out. They roll it out through some kind of update to their privacy policy and their data usage policy and their acceptable use policy or their terms of use or whatever it is that they require you to click through, some kind of contract of adhesion, whatever it is. Nobody's going to read it. Eventually somebody will read it, or there'll be somebody that's picked up by the cops in this way, and nobody will know how he got picked up until the defense counsel would then have to get the information through subpoena in discovery, and then all of a sudden it comes out. So it could have been years before this type of thing could have been discovered. You're totally right about that, Emmanuel.
All right. Rob, go ahead.
Yeah, and the whole tone of this, and this is a fascinating story on Ars Technica by Ashley Belanger, and this is just a shining example of the attitude that we've seen not only in, like, the tech startup world among, like, you know, tech bros, but among huge corporations like Amazon, in which somebody has the idea for something and they're like, surely everyone will love this. Everyone will think we're wonderful for doing this. And so much so that we're going to put out a Super Bowl ad, one of the most visible things you can do in the world of advertising, showing how great it is, and not think for a moment. None of the stages of review this must have gone through, did anyone say, you know, is anybody going to pick up on how creepy this is and how we're turning everyone's neighborhood into a panopticon? Will nobody object about this? No, they just put it out there, and we're left making a surprise Pikachu face when basically the people shouted back and said no.
Yeah, you know, if they'd just shown it to us, any one of us would have said this. You know, it's pretty obvious to people in our community that this is wrong. They don't get it. That's how out of touch they are. Well, you know, I'm happy that we were able to help educate them. And now let's see where we go from here. Okay, moving on. Dutch police have arrested a man for computer hacking. And that's not the end of the story. There's more to it. They gave him... I couldn't make this up. The Dutch police gave this guy in Holland their own sensitive files, and he didn't give them back. And they accused him of computer hacking. Yeah, the politie, which is what they say, how they refer to the police there. They said on Monday that a 40-year-old man from Ridderkerk was arrested on Thursday after he wound up with confidential documents, thanks to what officers acknowledge was their own cock-up. You can say that? Wow. Okay. I like that phrase. That's a good phrase. The chain of events reads less like a breach and more like an own goal. If you don't know what that is, look it up. In connection with a separate investigation, the man contacted the police on February 12th to report he had images that might be relevant. An officer responded by sending him a link so he could upload the files, except the link sent was a download link, effectively giving him access to confidential police documents. The man did not actively break in or exploit a vulnerability in the traditional sense. He simply clicked the link and gained access to material he was never meant to see. Dutch cops said they told him to stop and delete the material, but he allegedly refused, saying he would only do so if he received something in return. He did, in the end, get something in return, a trip in the back of a police car. Officers arrested the man Thursday evening, searched his home, and seized data storage devices to recover the documents and prevent them from being shared further. Police say they have reported the incident as a data breach and are continuing their investigation. Police also offered a lesson in link etiquette, saying, if you receive a download link, knowing you should be receiving an upload link, are clearly told not to download, and then choose to download the files anyway, you may be guilty of computer trespassing. Well, I never knew that, but let me counter that with a little advice for the Dutch police. If you send somebody a download link and you realize that was a dumbass move and you made a huge mistake, rather than telling the person to stop and don't download it, why don't you just rename the download link so they can't download it? Or are you misrepresenting the situation where the person already downloaded it and you're trying to get them to go back in time and not download the link in the first place? You know, there's a question of responsibility here. And clearly the Dutch police are not being responsible for their own mistake. If somebody downloads something, it's theirs. They have it. They can do whatever they want with it. And if you gave it to them, that's on you. I don't know, Alex, am I off base here legally?
No, it's crazy. This is one of the craziest stories. I mean, this is basically punishing some random person for what is essentially a police data breach. To my mind, this would be the police committing a data breach, and they're trying to pin it on somebody clicking a link. This is totally insane to me. I mean, he didn't guess the URL. He didn't brute force it. There's no unauthorized access. He didn't go through any kind of gates. They gave him, I think this was a one-time link, right?
So, oh, I don't know that.
From his, I think it was. So from his perspective, regardless, but if it was a one-time link, it would be even more convincing. But if it was even just a regular link, well, then it looks like something that he was supposed to use, and that would support a defensive argument that he reasonably believed that he was authorized to connect to whatever it was he was clicking on because the police gave it to him. this is just totally insane. I mean, I think it doesn't border on. I think it crosses the line squarely into abuse of process here. Charging this person is so clearly against I think the statute and the law, and the person had zero intent to do anything malicious here. And intent has to be present in any element of, I'm sorry, as an essential element of any kind of criminal conduct. You have to have the mental element, the mens rea, so to speak, which is the intentional position of your mind to do something that you weren't supposed to be doing. And clicking the link that the police give you doesn't result in anything even resembling that type of intent. So this is ridiculous.
Well, now you said that he didn't guess the link. Now, I maintain that if somebody does guess a link, it's on the open internet without a password. Is that a crime?
Mm-hmm. No, I would maintain that it wasn't either, because if something is open in an open directory, right, that's not necessarily bypassing any kind of security control if the directory is wide open on the web, right? But what I'm talking about is did he do anything that could make the police believe that he wasn't supposed to be where he was supposed to be, right? Like, say, so they can give him a link, and then he iterated on the link to find some other spot on the server that was different and open. You know, that I could see the police misinterpreting, I think that's good faith security research anyhow. And look, of course, this isn't legal advice to people. I'm not your lawyer. I'm not giving you legal advice to go and do this type of thing. But I think it would be very reasonable in my mind to make that type of argument. But here you don't even have that. You have an exact link that the police provided this person. He didn't modify it in any way. He didn't change it. He didn't add any code to it. He didn't, you know, remotely execute any kind of code on the web server. So it's, to my mind, a police data breach.
Yes, Rob, go ahead.
And of course, this was in the Netherlands, so I have no idea what the law is like in there. But the sheer fact of this, I believe you put it well, Alex. But also the fact that they told him to delete the stuff that he downloaded from this link they gave him, and then he proceeded to be a smartass about it and say, no, unless you give me something. I wish I had some more details as to what he wanted from the cops. Is it illegal to be a smartass when somebody else screws up and you end up with something through no fault of your own? I don't know. But, I am fascinated by this, and I would love...
The subscriber you have dialed is not in service. If you feel you've received this message in error, please hang up and try your call again later. Message MD0256.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. But if they could, they would. Phone Billy Bomb for the best, expect the worst. I hope that's understood. Phone Billy Bomb! We'll be right back.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening. Joined tonight by Kyle.
Hi.
Out in Signal Land, we have Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
We have Gila.
Good evening.
And we have Alex.
Good morning. I'm ensconced in Thursday over here.
Yeah, it's Thursday where you are already. Okay. I have to
say, for a long time.
You have a much better connection than you do here in New York. So wherever you are, that might be your new permanent place, because I don't think you've ever sounded better.
Is that right? Yeah. That's amazing. Maybe it's the acoustics of this lovely hotel room. I'm actually in Taipei right now in Taiwan. So pretty far away.
I don't think anyone on the show has ever been there before.
So this is a first.
Wow.
You know, March 2026, Off the Hook is broadcast from Taipei, Taiwan.
And note there's no latency. You're right there. There's no satellite delay, none of that stuff. It all seems to be quite local.
Yeah, the internet infrastructure here, I have to say, is pretty amazing. I mean, just the general infrastructure of Taipei is pretty excellent. I mean, I've been spending a lot of time on the subways over the last couple of days. But, I'm here for work, of course, so my days are taken up. But pretty extraordinary place. Have you guys ever been?
I've never been there. I've been to Beijing, which is in China. And I know there are all kinds of comparisons that people make between the two. For instance, okay, you mentioned you're on the subway. When the subway pulls in, does everybody try to get on first before all the people get off?
No.
Really?
No, absolutely
not. Because in Beijing and in Shanghai, they do that.
Oh, no. You know, it's quite interesting. When you get on the subway here, I find this so fascinating. Everybody is extremely courteous, number one. So the train will pull in. And the first time I got on the subway the other night, I started thinking to myself, well, what is this really beautiful music that's all of a sudden playing? And as the train is about to approach, the station will play some really sonorous music, you know, announcing the arrival of the train. It's nice. It's uplifting. The train is here. And then at every place where the train stops, there are three different arrows. And in the middle is an arrow pointing away from the train. And on the two sides of this rectangle are arrows pointing in. And so the people getting out leave through the middle, and the people coming in go along the sides. It's pretty simple.
Why don't they just wait for the people to get off the train?
Well, I guess it's this way you can have traffic going in and out at exactly the same time, so if people know where to stand.
It sounds to me like they have the same problem as Beijing had, except they're dealing with it by painting arrows. So people pass each other instead of waiting for each other. So that's interesting.
Well, yeah, there's that. And then there's also this other strange thing that happens in the subways where there are these rectangular boxes that go out from the door for a few feet and then over at a right angle. And you line up in these rectangular boxes and wait for the train. And then that's the order of entry for people boarding the train, is by standing in these rectangular boxes. It's very orderly.
Wow.
I have to say, I was very impressed.
And how long are you there for?
Well, I'm actually flying back tonight. So okay. I've been here. I left on Saturday. I was in London last week. Sorry to miss you guys. And so I fly back tonight. I leave this evening from Taipei and go kind of up and around Alaska, across the United States, across the international dateline, basically around the world. I arrive in New York only 3 hours after I leave the time in Taipei, because I cross the international dateline.
You may lose all of that time when you arrive due to the way airports. Well, you know what? I'll just let it be a surprise.
I've heard quite a bit, yeah, that our friends from ICE are doing, you know, menial administrative tasks and whatnot over at it's unbelievable that I have to come back to the United States and be greeted by, of all people, ICE.
And, you know, it's kind of remarkable that those bastards at ICE, you know, all due respect, they get paid for doing the job of the TSA workers who aren't getting paid. That just shows the injustice in this current
state. The whole thing has become just extremely psychotropic to listen to from afar, you know, over the last week and a half or so that I've been here. It's just unbelievable what's happening.
Well, I hope you bring back lots of stories, and you'll be in New York next week, I take it.
I will indeed. Yeah.
Well, that'll be a rarity. Maybe we'll see you at the No Kings rally on Saturday, because they're happening all over the country.
Oh, is that right? I was not aware of that. That's something. Yeah. Well, maybe. But I'm probably going to be in Pennsylvania this Saturday, I'm hoping.
They have them there, too.
I have heard. They need them there probably more than most places.
I'm sure they'll be hard to avoid.
Yeah, we'll have it come to you.
All right. Very good.
Make it as easy as possible. Hey, I know a lot of people want to talk about Hope. We're going to talk about Hope and the big announcement and all that. Yeah, it's back in Manhattan. But we're going to talk about that on Overtime. So Overtime is on YouTube, channel 2600 at 8 o'clock. We're happy to take calls and have an extended conversation or whatnot. We just have so much other material to get into, we're kind of sick of talking about it the last few weeks in our personal lives. There's so many stories going on, and one of the most interesting ones has to do with this Stryker hack. Have you heard about this? Now the U.S. Department of Justice. They've seized four domains belonging to the pro-Iran hacking group called Handala in the wake of an attack on the global medical giant known as Stryker. I don't know if that's the friendliest name for a medical giant, Stryker. It sounds violent. But the hackers behind that cyber attack basically wound up losing websites. in fact, the... I have some of the sites listed. Well, I had some of the sites listed. Here they are. JusticeHomeland.org, Handala-Hack.to, KarmaBelow80.org, and Handala-RedWanted.to. Does anybody know where .to is?
Is that Java?
I think might be. That's a common ccTLD for threat actors, though. A lot of them love to use that country code top-level domain.
Tonga.
There you go. Yeah.
Okay. Who can find Tonga on a map?
That's a good question.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. FBI Director Kash Patel, who cannot, by the way, was bullish regarding the success of the current operations against Handala and any future efforts to stymie the Iran-backed group. Iran thought they could hide behind fake websites and keyboard threats to terrorize Americans and silence dissidents. We took down four of their operations pillars, and we're not done. The FBI will hunt down every actor behind these cowardly death threats and cyber attacks, and we'll bring the full force of American law enforcement down on them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All fine and good, except how? The internet works globally. I'm curious how they managed to take down a .to site. Maybe it was hosted in the United States. But correct me if I'm wrong, the DOJ cannot just go out and shut down any website it wants. It has to have some amount of control over it in the first place. Alex, something about this.
Yeah. I mean, it depends on where the infrastructure is, whether you have a cooperating party on the other side of whatever the DOJ or FBI is requesting. With Tonga, they probably had some kind of coordination with the operator of the ccTLD, the country code top level domain for .to. Every country code top level domain has, an operator, right? And they're generally associated with the telecommunications infrastructure of the country for that particular ccTLD. So my guess is that they made some kind of multilateral assistance request over to Tonga, and Tonga complied and said, okay, sure, we'll take down this infrastructure. On the other hand, you could be absolutely right, Manuel, in that if you're using a .to domain, that domain can be it can point to any type of name server or any host, and it can be hosted by any company around the world. You could have a .to domain that's hosted in Russia. You could have a .to domain that's hosted in New Jersey. It doesn't really matter. That's how the internet works. But the other thing that I find just absolutely laughable, risible, as some would say, is that, they think that this is some kind of big win and taking down this threat actor infrastructure. It's a couple of domain names. Mm-hmm. It's not like they can't just spin up a couple of new domains.
Well, guess what they did? They spun up a few more domains. Yes.
Yeah.
It didn't take them more than a couple hours, I don't think. But yeah, they restored all the websites. In fact, I think they even have more now. But here's my question, and maybe it's a stupid question. I'm sure it is. Why didn't so-called hackers just use .ir, the Iranian top-level domain? Is it because their own government was shutting it down?
That's a good question, actually. I think that the .ir ccTLD, that country code top-level domain, is probably not as connected as it used to be. I bet you there's a lot of the infrastructure that has been disconnected as part of the internet blackout, so it's the service is probably sporadic. And yeah, it's really just a matter of personal preference, too. I mean, the .ir ccTLD operator certainly wouldn't cooperate with a multilateral assistance treaty from the United States. But domains, you know, are like weeds, right? I mean, they just pop up wherever you don't want them. It really doesn't matter whatever they want. If they want consistent infrastructure, then maybe .ir or .ru or something like that would have been better. But also, it is .ir domains are probably a lot harder to access on the client side. So if you want people to go to those domains, if you want publicity over towards them, they're probably going to be blocked in, you know, by a lot of firewall rules and various things that are blocking ccTLDs like .ir. So it also depends on what the point is of the threat actors. Do they want to bring the public's attention to these particular sites? Or do they just want to take up resources of the FBI by having them play whack-a-mole and take down all these domains while they just pop up new infrastructure?
I'll tell you, I never heard of these domains until DLJ started talking about them.
Yeah, well, that makes perfect sense, too, right? So now they're touting this as some massive win, but yet what they're doing is just bringing publicity to the messages that they're sending on these domains.
They get so few wins, Alex. Let them have this.
Yeah. I mean, it's the Streisand effect, I guess, in the form of a domain takedown.
Well, here's something a little bit more understandable, at least to me. There are 45,000 malicious IP addresses and servers out there, and there was a sweeping international cybercrime operation that dismantled them, coordinated by Interpol. The operation, known as Operation Synergia 3, I guess there were two other ones, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce Synergia either, but hopefully I'm doing it right. It brought together law enforcement agencies from 72 countries in a months-long effort to disrupt cybercriminal networks operating across continents. That's how you do it. That's how you cooperate. You bring people together. You bring countries together. 72 countries, law enforcement agents. You imagine the stories they traded. You know, that is, you combine your forces. You work together for a common goal. That makes more sense to me than a single country going out and saying, hey, look, we took down four websites for these nasty people. Yeah, they got more websites, but that's not what we're talking about today.
Yeah, I mean, these coordinated efforts are really kind of interesting, and they're, you know, taking down massive botnets and things require a lot of, you know, multilateral coordination between these agencies, between Interpol, and they're very effective. But you really have to think about, like, how are you going to squash this infrastructure? How are you going to create a lot of friction for this threat actor when you take down the infrastructure so that they don't just spin up new domains and or point the existing domains, if you've decided to take them down at the host level, to different hosts? You really have to be careful about what you say and tout as a victory, you know, while the bad guys on the other end are you know, making an end run around your place already.
Well, Operation Synergia 3 ran between July 18th of 2025 and January 31st of this year, combining intelligence sharing, cross-border coordination, and targeted enforcement actions. During this period, investigators identified key nodes within cybercriminal ecosystems and dismantled the infrastructure, enabling large-scale fraud and hacking campaigns. Beyond the technical takedown, the operation led to significant enforcement outcomes on the ground. Authorities confirmed 94 individuals were arrested. A further 110 suspects remain under investigation. And in addition, 212 electronic devices and servers were seized during raids across multiple countries. Doesn't sound like very many when you look at the scale of the story. I know people who have been raided who had more electronic devices than 212. But the coordinated actions were made possible by transforming large volumes of cyber threat data into actionable intelligence, allowing national police forces to identify and target key actors within criminal networks. They carried out raids on identified locations, disrupting operations ranging from phishing hubs, that's with a PH, to fraud rings and malware distribution systems. So, yeah, I don't think anybody can really say that's a bad idea. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, and Stryker, for those unfamiliar, is a manufacturer of medical equipment, things used in all sorts of medicine, and also things used inside people, medical devices. And they've been quick to announce that this hack didn't compromise anything relating to the medical devices that their customers and patients are using. So that seems good. This seems just to have affected Stryker's own system. But now Stryker itself is being sued. Four of their employees are suing Stryker for fear that their own employee PII, personal identifying information, was leaked to ne'er-do-wells in this hack. So they're looking to make that a class action suit, and it'll be interesting to see how that goes.
Yeah, and it's about time, too, that these companies that don't have sufficient security take responsibility for that. So having their own employees sue them because they were compromised, usually we don't hear about that. We don't hear about the victims and how their lives have been disrupted because of sloppiness. So it's good to see them finally saying something about it. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, this is a common thing nowadays. When there's a data breach, there's always some kind of a plaintiff's firm out there ready to file a lawsuit on behalf of the employees. And I'm not trying to undermine the validity of these claims. I think they are valid. And in fact, that I bring this up to my class. You guys know I one of the reasons why I'm often over in London is because I teach over at King's College in the law faculty there. And I teach through the lens of the great hacks. And I talk about different hacks and teach the law after we talk about how these hacks had happened. It's a fun course. But the first one that we do is about the Sony hack back in 2014. And that was, a massive data breach that affected so much internal information that was leaked, by North Korean threat actors. And there's some questions about whether it was North Korea or whether it was several threat actors running rampant through Sony systems at the time. There's still a lot of questions about that attribution, so I'll acknowledge that for a moment. But one of the things that I bring up in my lecture is that there was a woman who was an employee at Sony. And once the data was leaked back in 2014, the end of 2014 into 2015, there was a disciplinary report about her that had claimed that she had stolen some company property when she was leaving the company. And that there was this report. And then so anytime that she went and looked for a job after Sony, people would Google her name. That's just common practice. You Google your prospective employees' names. And this report would show up on the internet claiming that she was accused of theft. And it turns out that this report related to something like a $4 mouse that the company alleged she didn't return when she left Sony. And this report was basically preventing her from getting a job because everybody believed that she was some kind of kleptomaniac, inside a company. She couldn't get a job because of it. So these things, I think it just goes to really undermine that these claims are valid, that there are real people that are affected by this. Once the data is out there on the internet, accurate or not, it can be misleading.
Wait, did you say it was because of a mouse?
A mouse.
One mouse.
One mouse. There was a report inside Sony about this particular woman having stolen, I think it was a $4 or $6 mouse. It might have been $6.
So what kind of companies would not give her a job because somebody else accused her of taking a $4 mouse?
Well, it wasn't clear from the information on the report that was available online that it actually related to a $4 or $6 mouse. It just was a report of theft of company property.
I see. Okay. All right. Wow. They're pretty petty over there at Sony.
Yeah, you would think so, right? I mean, unbelievable. I mean, just think about the amount of time and effort you would have to spend to submit that report. Way over $6 worth of your time.
Somebody had an issue of one sort or another and really wanted to get even. Okay.
I think so.
All right. Getting back to the United States versus the whole rest of the world. Now we have banned new foreign-made consumer internet routers. That this is almost unbelievable. And an update Monday to a list of equipment seen as not secure enough for use. The Federal Communications Commission.